and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the high-stakes showdown over the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau intensified today as both Mick Mulvaney and Leandra English declared that they were assuming leadership of the agency. Next, in a dramatic turnaround, the leader of Germany's Social Democratic Party has expressed his openness to joining a coalition led by Chancellor Angela Merkel, throwing a lifeline to the embattled leader. Then, new information has come to light about the Keystone Pipeline, operated by the same TransCanada corporation that is constructing the Keystone XL pipeline that was the subject of the Standing Rock protests, has leaked far more frequently than the company had projected. And then an ally of Manuel Zelaya, the former leader of Honduras who was overthrown in a U.S.-backed coup, appears to have won the country's presidential election. The corporate media is shocked at the result. And finally, Al Franken returned to the Senate today. John Conyers continues to resist calls to resign, and Roy Moore continues to campaign in Alabama despite a mountain of sexual harassment allegations against the three of them. Congress truly has no shame. That's all starting now on Loud and Clear. But first, we take a look at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The high-stakes showdown over the CFPB intensified today as both Mick Mulvaney and Leandra English declared that they were assuming leadership of the agency. We're joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter, a columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Businessweek, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. Dave, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Dave, how does such a kerfuffle even start? You have two different people who both claim to be the head of the same federal bureaucracy. What are we missing here?
Well, There's two rules here that are at work, and they're each in on a different rule. The president typically with federal agencies has the right to name a recess appointee when Congress isn't able to approve the person, and they can put them in until Congress approves them. So he's approving Mulvaney because the current head of the agency is resigning. The resignation was done in a hurry because he realized what was going to happen, and so he made a move to appoint his own successor under the rules as drawn up for the agency's formation in the Dodd-Frank bill, which says that, you know, I forget the person's title, becomes the deputy director or acting director in the case of the director leaving. So it's which rule applies, the one that was written up for the agency's founding in consultation. And he has a good argument, by the way, because that rule was established in a debate between House and Senate conferees, and they settled on that as the appropriate way to replace a person who left as the director before their term was up. So that's pretty sound legal basis for saying they have the right to do it.
We have a situation, Dave, where the issue of governance, not just in this agency, but all across the board, is really being called into question. When you're the largest country in the world, with the biggest military in the world, with the biggest economy in the world, the biggest diplomatic corps in the world, the issue of governance actually does matter, and there's a war going on.
I'm not sure it's the biggest diplomatic corps anymore, after all the layoffs and resignations, but...
Well, true enough. Well, but that's part of it. Part of this war as well. I mean, you have the Secretary of State gutting the career officer spots in the State Department, perhaps by as much as a third. Who knows whether those jobs mean anything or not? But that aside from content, what we have here is a real struggle not only between Democrats and Republicans, but between parts of the civil service corps and the existing administration. And of course, we had gridlock during the Obama years because the Republicans said, we want you to fail. And everything Obama did was countered by, or almost everything, unless it was about war, which the Republicans were for. But everything else, they tried to have fail. Talk about what the impact of this kind of internecine struggle going on within the U.S. government, what its impact might be, not just on consumers. The Consumer Protection Board agency was presumably designed to protect consumers after the great 2008 Great Recession, where so much fraud and corruption impacted on homeowners and others. And of course, maybe 30 million people lost their job. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, looking at it most broadly, you have an effort by the Trump administration, aided by the Republican majorities in both houses, to undo virtually anything, really anything, that was done in the Obama administration. It's not even the progressive things. It's like anything. And there weren't that many progressive things Obama did. So they're going after, if basically, if Obama did it, Trump wants to undo it, and Congress wants to undo it, and they especially want to undo anything progressive that was done, like the creation of the CFPB. So what the importance of this is that in addition to naming people to head these agencies, you know, like the EPA or the Interior Department or the Energy Department, anybody, what they try to do is they name people who want to destroy anything progressive. So they name anti-environmentalists to the Interior Department, climate deniers to the EPA, and so on, to actually wreck the agencies. And that Mulvaney is a classic example. He comes from a position, I think, in Congress where he was like, he declared himself to be the number one enemy of the CFPB after it was formed. And, you know, he was the budget director first, and now he's being moved over when the opportunity presents itself to go to the agency that he wants to wreck. And that'll be his job. But that's been going on, and now what we're seeing also is that, you know, when you try to wreck an agency, one of the things that blocks you from doing it is the civil service staff who are in there for, you know, the career people who you know the agency, love the work, try to do it well, and are protected by civil service rules. And so if you can go after that, you know, second tier leadership who have the civil service standing and get rid of them, get drive people out by bad treatment as they're doing at the State Department and so on, you can really destroy those agencies.
And it sometimes takes, you know, a generation to rebuild agencies like that. Part of the problem that I think the anti-Trump forces are going to have in this is a statement that was made by Mary McLeod on Saturday. She is the CFPB's general counsel, and she was hired during the Obama administration by Cordray, who also was an Obama appointee. But she said that...
And Cordray is the one who's leaving.
Who's leaving, correct. She said that her reading of the law is, and this is a quote, "There should be no question that Director Mulvaney is the acting director." And this is something that she also recommended to the Justice Department. So it's as though anybody who loved the CPFB or had a stake in its success is being shunted to the side, and there's nowhere to go. Are we looking at a long-term dismantling of this new agency?
Oh yeah, I think it's curtains for this agency. You know, in the short term, it could be. You know, I don't think they can make it go away. So the legislation will be there unless it's changed in Congress. But you know, the Republicans are so in the pocket of the banking industry that they really wanted. That's like their gift to the banking industry. So. To get rid of it. So I think it's really going to be, for the near term, a dysfunctional or non-functional agency. It's possible the law will still be in place so that it could be restaffed up if there was a change in the political ownership in Washington. But short term, yeah.
You know, we had a Obama had a hard time appointing anybody to be the director because the Republicans just wouldn't approve anybody.
Yes.
So he appointed Cardray, the one who's leaving now and who's probably going to run for governor of Ohio. He appointed him as a recess appointment in January, I think it's 2012, maybe 2013. He eventually got approved by the Senate. And at that time, too, Obama tried to use recess appointments to get three members of the National Labor Relations Board. But then a conservative Republican dominated Supreme Court said it was unconstitutional. He couldn't appoint those. In other words, you have a war going on where each side, and in this case, the Republicans, and of course, as you said, with the backing of Wall Street, have gone to war against an agency, however minimally effective it was designed to protect consumers from happening to them what happened in 2007, 2008.
Yeah, no, it did some really pretty good things, actually, you know, individual things, you know, protecting students from student loan fraud and so on. But it was prevented from even functioning for a while. And so it got off to a slow start. You know, the whole thing is kind of interesting because when you look at the whole political system, there's really not that much difference between Republicans and Democrats, and this whole war is all about who controls the levers of power and gets all the patronage and the money from the corporations that fund these guys. It's like the policies aren't that different, but this is a case where, you know, the Democrats were doing pretty well with Wall Street.
I'm sorry that I have to stop you on that point, Dave. That was Dave Lindorf joining us from Philadelphia. He is an investigative reporter, columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Business Week, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. Thanks for joining us. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
In a dramatic turnaround, the leader of the Social Democratic Party of Germany has expressed his openness to joining a coalition led by Chancellor Angela Merkel, throwing a lifeline to the embattled leader and her party. We are joined from Berlin by Rainer Braun, co-president of the International Peace Bureau. Welcome back, Rainer.
Thank you.
This might be pretty big news. What accounts for the turnaround, if in fact it is a turnaround for the SPD, the Social Democratic Party of Germany? They would form a common cause with the conservative CDU, a Christian Democratic Union, led by Angela Merkel. Do you think it will happen?
I think so. You know, there will be some games between. They will say they are open for all the three solutions, a minority government, a government, new elections, or a government between conservatives and social democrats. And in the end, the social democrat will jump again in the old bed of Angela Merkel. And frankly speaking, it will be the end of the traditional social democratic party and is the beginning of a new middle neoliberalistic governmental coalition which will try to rule the country for the next year, and which will continue the old traditional politics of militarization, of a new military union in Europe, of 2% for NATO. So nothing new. It is the old shit. But, you know, it is definitely the end of the Social Democratic Party as a party which is connected to global justice. That is really the end. And we will see what will be the new development. We will see what will happen with the members of the Social Democratic Party. Will they still stay in this party? I think a lot of them will leave the party. Maybe some of them will go to the left. Others maybe will form new parties or new networks. We will see. It is for the Social Democratic Party, with its historical approach, it is really the end.
Rainer Braun, if it's the end of the road for the Social Democratic Party, and just for our audience, the Social Democratic Party is a historical party in Germany. I mean, going back after the anti-socialist laws were lifted in the end of the 19th century, It quickly became the number one party in Germany by 1914, maybe by 1910. If it's the end of the party for them to become a minority partner with a Christian Democratic Union, a conservative party, why would they do it?
You know, traditionally, the social democratics have the are needed when there are big problems in the country, when they need to develop the next step for an unsecure future. Then they always ask the Social Democratic Party to become a member of the government to rule the country together with the conservatives. It is historically not new. You know, the First World War, and all the socialist countries were against war, but when it comes to the decision at the end, all the Social Democratic parties were with all the conservatives, with the royalist forces supporting the war. The second happened after the war. They were not supporting revolutionary changes in the country. They were going with the traditional forces to save the capitalistic system in the country. So, and now we have again a situation where the Social Democratic can create with others a left front for changes in the country, or they can establish the old neoliberalistic system, and they're doing it again. So it is really the traditional role of the Social Democratic Party to be a little bit the doctor at the bed of the capitalistic system, and when the system is ill, the Social Democratic are jumping in to help surviving it. But, you know, this role reduced because the people don't want to have the system any longer. So the Social Democratic, which got 10 years or 12 years ago about 35%, 5 years more, 15 years ago, they got 40%. They reduced now to 20% because the people don't believe any longer in their role as a social justice party. They are looking for new parties or new circumstances, how to work politically. And that will be a dramatic ongoing process when the Social Democrats will again go into the government with the conservatives, which is not a government of change, which is a government of conservation of old traditional neoliberalistic politics.
Reiner, what exactly is the motivation here for all these parties to enter into a coalition again? Is it a fear of what the extreme right has done in this last round of elections, or is there something else?
You know, it is also for the Social Democrats in the spirit, we are the helpers to create a new government. We are helping that the political system can go on. And they're very proud of that, that they are really can help after these, what they are calling instability by not getting together this Jamaica coalition. And this is the traditional role of Social Democrats to jump in when a situation is instable. That is one point. The other point, you never forget, you know, all the parliamentarians have a 100,000 euro job per year. It's a good paid job. And then now immediately after the elections to have new elections, no one knows who will be elected again. And to lose a job from this good condition so quickly, that is not what they want. And, you know, the third point is there is a lot of positions in the government. There are ministers, there's state secretaries, there are leading positions in the bureaucracy, which have a good car, which have a good income, which is accepted in the society. I think all these mixture of reasons brought the change in the Social Democratic Party. In the leadership of the Social Democratic Party, we will see how the basic groups of the Social Democratic Party will react. We have a first reaction of the so-called young socialists, which are deeply against this big coalition. But my feeling is the Social Democratic Party is a party of functionaries and bureaucrats. At the end, the leaders will win and bring the Social Democrats into this so-called big coalition in Germany.
In addition to the corruption, or the, well, maybe it's not corruption, just the perks and the privileges that go in with being a parliamentarian, the $100,000 per year, per seat euro, 100,000 euros per seat, all the other perks and privileges that go along with it, the cabinet positions possibly. But that aside, if there was another quick election, who would be the big winner? Because you had the AfD, Alternative for Germany, the right-wing party. They were the ones who made the really large gains in the last election that sort of upset the apple cart. Is it possible that in early or quick elections that they would be gaining again even larger numbers?
You know, we have first polls after the breaking of the Jamaica discussions or the Jamaica negotiations. And all the polls show that there are not big changes in the minds of the people. The right wing even lost a little bit because they also have a lot of internal controversies. And their behavior with each other is not very, how to say, very fine. And also, it comes more and more scandals from these guys to the public, anti-Semitic lectures, coalitions with fascists, fake news that they were producing. So they have also a lot of problems. And this reduced even a little bit their position in the polls. And, you know, the winners in the polls, the small winners, are the Greens. Because, you know, people say they were negotiating quite clever. But in general, there is there will be not a big change. So there will be not a big change, but an insecure situation if you will be elected. Because many of these people which were elected, it was very, very small advantages which you had for the next candidate. So you could not be sure if you will be re-elected by the next elections. And so there will be definitely not a new situation. There will be, again, the two possibilities or the three possibilities. Either you can have a so-called Jamaica coalition, you can have a big coalition, or you can have a minority government. So no big change. But, you know, elections cost about $100 million or $120 million. This is expensive.
In the United States, they're a source of profit. They're not a drain.
Indeed.
The U.S. spends $3 billion dollars on the presidential election alone.
No, you know, I'm only speaking about arranging. I'm not speaking about making the campaign by the different parties. And never forget, all the different parties are financially quite bankrupt. All of them have big debts. So again, the debts of these parties will be higher. So there are a lot of very bureaucratic and very formal arguments and reasons why not to go to new elections when there is not a, then there will be not a big change. So it is a situation where, for my understanding, the best solution would be we bring the politics back to the parliament, and the main decisions will be developed by discussion in the parliament. This means I'm in favor of having a minority government, like we have it for many, many years in Sweden, in Denmark, in Italy, in many, many other countries. And the main discussions will be in parliament, and the government has to search for a majority for their politics. And this is a new, open, very democratic process where the public can be engaged with much more activities and actions and suggestions. So my personal view is for the democracy development of Germany, for more democracy in this parliamentarian democracy, it would be great to have for the first time a minority government with a very open process for searching for majorities.
We'll see if that indeed happens. We've been joined from Berlin by Rainer Braun. He's the co-president of the International Peace Bureau. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
New information has come to light about the Keystone Pipeline, operated by the same TransCanada Corporation that is constructing the Keystone XL Pipeline that was the subject of the Standing Rock protests. It has leaked far more frequently than the company ever projected. We are joined from Burlington, Vermont by Fred Magdoff, Professor Emeritus of Plant and Soil Science at the University of Vermont, and the co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism, and also Creating an Ecological Society Toward a Revolutionary Transformation. Fred, welcome back. Thanks for joining us again.
Good to be back with you.
We're glad to have you. So tell us what we're looking at here. This is another environmental disaster, something that so many people predicted would happen. Now it happened. and the government hasn't said a word about it.
Well, this isn't the first time it happened also. I mean, the reality is that the pipelines leak and that the oil, the material that's coming from the tar sands is particularly corrosive, so that it is more prone to have leakages in the normal pipelines than regular oil being shipped through the pipeline.
This is not the first time this has happened. Indeed, in 2010, there was a 5,000-barrel spill. There was a 5,000-barrel spill in South Dakota this month. There were 400 barrels spilled in South Dakota last year, 400 barrels in North Dakota in 2011. We're getting to the point where this is almost not newsworthy.
Yeah, I mean, pipelines break. They spill. They get corroded. Sometimes the welding isn't done well. On the individual pipes as they're being put together. There are all sorts of reasons for failure. But yes, this is a problem. And this is with the former Keystone Pipeline, which they basically want to build it's like a diagonal cutting across South Dakota and Nebraska and to meet up with the other pipelines. And it would go right over, by the way, at least a portion of a very important aquifer, the Oglala Aquifer in parts of eastern Nebraska. So, I think it's a big deal. There are other issues also, by the way.
Talk about those issues.
Well, one of the things is that the tar sands, first off, the oil, exploiting the tar sands is particularly damaging to the environment. These are very dirty deposits. Chemicals are released during the extraction process. You're destroying forests. You're polluting rivers. The First Peoples, the Native Canadians, are not able to eat the fish nearby because of contamination with metals, etc. So you've got a particularly dirty material, dirty in extraction and corrosive when it's being shipped. And also, it's expensive to produce, at least by some of the processes. So it may be some of the sites may be actually making money. But some of them are losing money because they need $70 a barrel equivalent of oil.
Break even.
In order to break even, yeah. So some of them can break even around 50, 45 to 50 using a particular type of extraction procedure. So this is the other part of it. On the other hand, they've invested all this money so that even if they're losing money, they're going to be producing because if they don't produce, they're going to lose more money.
Yeah, that's right. You know, Brian, Reuters reported today that in TransCanada's operating permit application, the company predicted that there would be spills, but they estimated that, and this is a direct quote, there would be no more spills than once every 41 years. That was the prediction.
That's an unusual number.
Once every 41 years, they were predicting a spill. For Keystone XL, they were also estimating spills, but spills that would come more frequently, once or twice a decade, 3 barrels or less. Fred, how does a company get away with writing something like this on an operating permit application when the people they're supposed to be reporting to ought to know better?
And also, let's just go back. I mean, tens of thousands of people participated in civil disobedience actions to stop the Keystone XL pipeline.
That's right.
This is another similar pipeline. Finally, under political pressure, Barack Obama said, let's just wait. Let's do an environmental impact study to see whether the assertions of the company match up with our own scientific estimates or the Army Corps of Engineers estimate. And on the basis of an environmental impact study, he basically stalled the thing out. Mm-hmm. And then Donald Trump came in the Republican Party, drill baby drill, and Donald Trump was an investor in the Keystone XL pipeline. Had $1 million investment in it. He signs an executive order insisting that it go ahead. Now, the people who were there protesting and protecting, they said they were water protectors, not water protesters. And these were indigenous communities who said, by the way, it's not your land, it's our land, and you can't do it without our approval. They got demonized. They got attacked. They got attacked with tear gas, with rubber bullets, with attack dogs. You know, people lost an eye. Another person lost an arm. I mean, horribly brutal treatment. There, a lot of them are on trial right now and going to trial and facing long prison sentences for their resistance. And here you have, sort of ironically, Donald Trump, who helped create the atmosphere where they could be repressed. He's now meeting with indigenous war veterans, Indian people. Here he is, like, ripping up indigenous treaties, trampling all over them. And today at the White House, when he met these Navajo code talkers, he said, I just want to thank you because you are very, very special people. You were here long before us, before any of us were here. Who's the us? I guess that's the non-indigenous people, the Europeans, I guess. Although we have a representative in Congress who has been here for a long time, longer than you, they call her Pocahontas. He then turned to one of the code talkers behind him, put his left hand on the man's shoulder and said, but you know what? I like you. You are special people. I mean, this is the president of the United States. I mean, tearing up the rights of indigenous people, helping to carry out the repression against those who are trying to protect the water of indigenous people and all of us, and yet talking like this at the White House. It's amazing when you put it all together. I mean, it would be laughable if it wasn't so offensive.
Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable. It really is. And also, by the way, the pipeline was going to cut, I mean, the XL is supposed to cut a path that goes through territory that was never ceded by the Sioux. You know, they were given, as part of a settlement, there was a reservation, a formal reservation that was outlined, but there was land outside the reservation in which they were supposed to have rights to use, you know, for hunting and for fishing and for, you know, whatever they wanted. And that land is land that that the pipeline is cutting through. So at least, you know, a portion of it is cutting through that land. He is a... Trump is a disgusting individual. What can you say?
I think that sums it up. I think that sums it up. Fred Magdoff is right. Donald Trump is a disgusting individual. You heard it right here on Loud and Clear.
One of the things that's so sad about this whole story is here we have this large, filthy spill. And as Fred has pointed out, this isn't, you know, pure Libyan crude we're talking about that's, you know, the cleanest, practically sulfur-free oil on earth. This is filthy oil, this tar sand oil. It's filthy and it's full of poison. And we've got a president who has staffed the Environmental Protection Agency with climate deniers and people who are in the pay of the oil companies. And nothing's going to get done. Nothing's going to be cleaned up. This is all going to be pushed under the rug. And then there's going to be another spill and they're going to do the same thing again.
And the indigenous water protectors are going to still be on trial.
That's right.
Probably without a lot of money for great legal counsel. There are a lot of volunteer lawyers. I talked to some of the people who are involved in that. There's the attorneys from here in Washington who are helping from the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. They're helping. Other lawyers are coming forward, some from the National Lawyers Guild on the West Coast. Lawyers are coming to help. But these are isolated communities who did so much to try to sort of sound the alarm and say to everyone, look, these things are going to leak. And now they're facing trial while Reuters is telling us, not the government, the Reuters is telling us that the leak's bigger than what has been known before. Fred Magdoff, 45 seconds, you get the last word. What do you want to tell the people here in Washington, D.C. and around the United States?
Well, one thing to keep in mind, I have been opposed to the Keystone XL pipeline, and I'm very sorry that Nebraska, you know, court decided that this is last week, that it could be built, although there are some conditions. One thing to keep in mind is that it's still not sure that that pipeline is going to be built, partially because of the economics of it and the economics of tar sands at this point relative to the price of oil on the world market, because all of this oil is being exported, right? So this is all to get oil from Canada to Texas so that it can be shipped abroad. It has nothing to do with any use of energy in the United States.
It's for the profit of already very, very, very rich people. We've been joined from Burlington, Vermont by Fred Magdoff, Professor Emeritus of Plant and Soil Science at the University of Vermont. He is the co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Towards a Revolutionary Transformation. After a short break, you'll be right back with us. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
An ally of Manuel Zelaya, the former leader of Honduras who was overthrown in a U.S.-backed coup, appears to have won the country's presidential election. The corporate media is shocked at the result. We're joined from Tucson by Chuck Kaufman. He's the national coordinator of the Alliance for Global Justice. And we're also joined by Walter Smolarek, our Sputnik News analyst. Thank you both for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
So let's start with Chuck. Chuck, this is a momentous day for Honduras, and it's barely made the U.S. news. What happened today?
Well, it looks like the leader of the Alliance Against Re-election has won the election instead of Juan Orlando Hernandez, the sitting president of the National Party.
And Hernandez was an authoritarian leader. He was sort of installed in the position in a coup that was backed by the Obama administration.
Hillary Clinton
as Secretary of State at the time.
Well, there was an election between the coup and the 2013 election where Juan Orlando was elected, but essentially it was a continuation of the coup government.
So talk about Salvador Nasrallah, former sportscaster running at the head of this left-wing alliance. What are his politics? What does he say? Let's compare him, say, to Hugo Chavez or to the Workers' Party in Brazil, a little bit not quite as far left as Chavez or Maduro in Venezuela. Where do you place Nasrallah?
Well, not anywhere on that spectrum. He's very much a centrist. He had a party and ran in 2013 and came in fourth with some seats in the National Assembly against corruption. He's mostly known as a television radio personality. The coalition, electoral coalition, is made up mostly by the Libre Party of Zelaya's party. So legislatively and hopefully members of the government will be to the left, but Nasrallah himself is no leftist.
Walter, it's an interesting combination, and we've seen this in other places where the individual running at the head of the ticket is not as far left as the far left parties, or what the media calls far left parties, are supporting. Why pick someone like that? Just because of name recognition?
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic, and it's actually quite similar to the dynamic that played out when Manuel Zelaya was president prior to being overthrown in the coup in 2009. So he was the head of the Liberal Party, which was one of the two traditional ruling parties in Honduras. Zelaya himself, I believe, was a major landowner, at least his family was a major landowning family. But because of the dynamics in the region where there's this rising tide of progressive forces, there was a move towards Latin American integration that still exists, but you know, some of the wind has been taken out of the sails of that process. Manuel Zelaya moved sharply to the left and aligned himself actually with the ALBA, the Bolivarian Alliance for the Peoples of Our America, which was the alliance set up originally by Cuba and Venezuela and then was expanded to include, I think at its height, about 9 different countries. So Zelaya was overthrown, and then Zelaya set up his own party, like Chuck was saying, the Libre Party, the Freedom and Refoundation Party, which was substantially to the left of the Liberal Party, which actually also ran a candidate in this election. Nasrallah, I agree with Chuck. He's not a leftist. He was actually the former head of Pepsi's operation in Honduras, but he's
Pepsi
sort of
Revolution.
Yeah, but he's sort of staked out this position. He's like an anti-corruption crusader. He's seen as like outside of the traditional political establishment. And so I think that, you know, the orientation of Zelaya, who was the chief strategist of Nasrallah's campaign, was that we need somebody who can be broadly acceptable to the masses of Honduran people and voters who wouldn't be sort of perceived as being part of this previous dynamic between the coup and anti-coup forces, although clearly what his election would do is break the continuation of rule by the National Party that's persisted in one form or another since 2009.
Chuck, there's a constitutional provision in Honduras that a president is not permitted to succeed himself. Is that correct? Is that still the case?
That is still the case. He got a Supreme Court ruling that the Constitution was unconstitutional.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you. So do you think this is going to lead to more political instability? The New York Times, for one, is citing it as the very reason for the 2009 coup, because Zelaya had initially intended to try to do something to get around that ban.
Well, that's what they were saying at the time. There wasn't any truth to it then, and there isn't any truth to it now. All the predictions are just up in the air right now. I'm shocked that the National Party allowed this to slip away from them after the blatant fraud that I saw in 2013, and they held more of the levers of power this time. I'm just shocked at the results.
When you say what you saw in 2013, talk about what you did.
Right. In 2013, I led, on behalf of the Honduras Solidarity Network, a delegation of 55 credentialed international election observers. So we were, able to be in at all stages. And we saw blatant vote buying. We saw numbers changed at the voting tables. I monitored two tables myself, and when the results were posted on the Supreme Electoral Tribunal's website, one of them was accurate, and the other one was completely different than the numbers that I wrote down when the count took place. So there was massive fraud in 2013, and I think maybe Juan Orlando forgot how much fraud it took to get him elected in 2013, and that he actually had some voter support.
Yeah, we're speaking with Chuck Kaufman. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined by John Kiriakou. Chuck Kaufman was an observer and led an international election observers group of 55 to Honduras in 2013. We're talking about the surprise outcome, the electoral outcome, where the ruling party appears to have lost the election this time around. Walter, it's interesting. Chuck Kaufman is accusing the current government of not rigidly enforcing their own voter fraud in a significant way, the way they had in 2013. And as a consequence, he's surprised they lost the election, not because they're unpopular, but because the vote rigging just isn't up to par.
That's kind of the only logical explanation for it that I can think of. And, there were lots of accusations of fraud this time around. But, yeah, it just doesn't seem to have been enough fraud to do it. Honduras also, in addition to the vote rigging, one of the ways that the Honduras, post-coup government has been able to enforce its rule, enforce the rule of the right-wing party, is through bloody suppression of social movements. That includes the student movement. There was a large anti-corruption movement, I believe, last year or the year before. And so the indigenous struggle there, I mean, there's no shortage of like mass people's movements that exist in Honduras, but the police and other authorities have, pretty brutally repressed them.
Chuck, I have a question for you. What does Nasrallah's election mean for the Honduran people in terms of day-to-day issues? Things like economic development or violence, let's say, or land distribution, redistribution. Is anything really going to change?
Well, that depends on what the results are for the National Assembly. If the National Party has a majority or close to it in the National Assembly, it's going to be hard for Nasrallah to do anything, to reverse some of the things that have happened. But if Libre and some of the other small parties have enough to elect Manuel Zelaya president of the National Assembly, then with Zelaya in the legislature and Nasrallah at the head of the executive, things might change. I mean, a huge change would be if they would start to enforce the law that allows peasant cooperatives to get title to land that they've occupied and productively used for 7 years.
Chuck Hoffman, 1 minute left. How will Washington react to this?
Probably they'll accept it and, you know, move to constrain Nasrallah from left things that he might want to do.
Yeah, of course, the United States, as we know, has interfered constantly, both in Honduras and almost all of the countries of the region. We've been speaking from Tucson, Arizona, with Chuck Hoffman. He's the national co-coordinator of the Alliance for Global Justice. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a very short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Al Franken returned to the Senate today. John Conyers continues to resist calls to resign. And Roy Moore continues to campaign in Alabama despite a mountain of sexual harassment allegations against him and others. We are joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He is a journalist and author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Welcome back, Daniel.
Hi, how you doing?
Very good. One thing about this, Daniel, I mean, this is an important moment. All of these allegations where women who have been abused or harassed, and some men, but mostly women, coming forward to identify incidents whereby they have suffered abuse and suffered it more or less in silence because the abusers were powerful people. This is in entertainment, in sports, in politics. It's across the board. It's an important moment, no doubt. But it's shaping up in Congress to be sort of a partisan affair. If you're a Democrat like Nancy Pelosi, then what John Conyers did, what John Conyers might have done, what Al Franken did, what many others have done, that seems to be no big deal unless, of course, it happens to be a Republican like Roy Moore, who then, you know, there's a completely different standard. And likewise, the Republicans, too, seem to be pursuing this purely as a partisan affair. As a consequence, the big issue, the fundamental issue, the issue of sexual abuse and harassment and women's rights in particular, seems to take back place to partisan bickering.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is the way American politics have been run at least since Watergate, certainly since the Bill Clinton and the Little Blue Dress scandal in the 90s. I mean, it's a game of gotcha where, you know, each side tries to tag the other with some kind of scandal, sexual peccadillo or other, and that's how politics are waged. It's extremely bad. I mean, all issues are pushed aside as they sort of engage in these vicious interpersonal wars, and both sides do it.
Daniel, it seems to me that despite all of the progress that's been made since the Weinstein revelations, which are now what, a month ago, a month and a half ago, many of our elected officials just simply haven't gotten the message yet. I have to tell you that personally, I'm outraged by Nancy Pelosi's statement on John Conyers, saying that, well, she's got to stick by John Conyers because he hasn't had due process yet. But by that standard, Roy Moore hasn't had due process. Donald Trump hasn't had due process. Why is it that our elected officials just don't seem to get it, that some issues are black and white, they're right and wrong, and they should really be on the side of right here?
Because they're locked in a desperate battle for advantage, momentary advantage, and they've got to use every weapon to bear. And it doesn't mean, it doesn't matter how faulty the weapon is, how dirty it is, how low the trick, they got to do it. So the two sides are going at each other, you know, hammer and tong and whatnot. And this gets worse and worse each passing year. Every, you know, it's more scandal-ridden, more scandal-obsessed. It just keeps going on and on.
Brian, what do you think? What do you think public opinion polls would show if a Democratic leader went up to a podium and said into the microphone, "Al Franken's got to go, John Conyers has to go. There's no place for this kind of thing in American society." What do you think the opinion polls would say? Vice, well, he hasn't had his day in court yet.
Yeah, it depends. I mean, I think the broad public is yearning for something that seems authentic and genuine and not purely for advantage between these two sort of dominant ruling class parties. I mean, I'm looking at an article in The Nation magazine. It's written by Lila Lalami, and she's making this point that this is going to be we can't end sexual harassment if we make it a partisan issue. Sexual harassment is not limited to any party, race, or religion. And, you know, she then documents, as we all know, but in sort of succinctly, how this has become such a broad brush because so many men, especially, are involved in it. The parade of horribles, this is her article, that the Times reports helped bring out includes Hollywood executives, Roy Price of Amazon Studios, film directors Brett Ratner, James Toback, A-list actors Kevin Spacey, Dustin Hoffman, Ben Affleck, popular comedians Louis C.K., media figures Mark Halperin, and former President George H.W. Bush. Again, that doesn't include Bill Clinton, who not right. only was having sex in the Oval Office with a 21-year-old intern, but was also accused by many women of engaging not only in having affairs, but also sexual abuse and sexual assault.
And accused quite plausibly, too, I would add.
Yeah.
Indeed.
And so in the past, if a single accuser was accusing a powerful figure, a powerful man, it was easy to have those charges dismissed. But right now in this Me Too moment, you know, women are coming forward and they don't have to prove absolutely. They have to be able to make an assertion. If there's 30 other women who are making the similar assertions, people say, oh, not only plausible, credible.
Yeah, there's something to this.
Yeah. In other words, the women who were on the defensive before are now able to come forward. But again, it completely trivialized when you have Nancy Pelosi defending Democratic abusers and the Republicans defending Republican abusers. And again, it shows that there is, in fact, no actual legitimate, credible political leadership coming from this political system. That's the way I see it. I mean, it seems to me that for this to really keep going and become something, it has to be a grassroots movement.
I agree. But first of all, I don't think there's any political leadership on anything in the United States. I think that Congress is entirely reactive. It's concerned with day-to-day trivialities. There is no leadership at all. And I think that's one of the really big problems in American politics. This is just a huge vacuum, a political vacuum that all kinds of forces are rushing to fill. So it's a shame that it has to remain a grassroots effort, because these are issues that require some kind of serious, addressing. But they're not being addressed. So the whole thing will keep on, we'll keep on going until it peters out and the next scandal comes up, somewhere down the road. And there will be one. And it'll be even bigger and even worse than this one.
Well, and this may be more than a scandal, though, because it's not, quote, a sex scandal. In fact, what I think we're witnessing is sort of an uprising of women, especially against sexual assault. Now, back when Clarence Thomas was almost about to be confirmed and was eventually confirmed as a Supreme Court justice, it was Joe Biden, the Democrat, not a Republican like Clarence Thomas, a conservative Republican, Joe Biden, who basically crushed Anita Hill, black female law professor's testimony that Clarence Thomas had engaged in sexual misconduct and sexual abuse of her. And now Biden is being called to task too for it. In other words, there is, in addition to the partisan politics issue, there is the old boys club part of this, where men are protecting each other until this uprising is taking place. And now it's breaking down along partisan lines. Like, we're going to be against Republican abusers or Democratic abusers, depending on where we are. But it seems to me that the uprising against sexual misconduct might be more than just a passing scandal. It might be some, we might be at a turning point.
Scandals are very important. I mean, Watergate was a scandal. That was a turning point also. But I just wanted to say, just to make one correction, remember, in response to Bill Clinton's sex escapades, it was really as much an old girls club as it was an old boys club, because the feminist movement, which is overwhelmingly Democratic, rallied around Bill and Hillary and really just used the most brutal tactics.
And
silencing women who had complained about Clinton. It was an amazing thing to watch. But there was these feminists, like Gloria Steinem, for example, really used heavy muscle to quiet, to suppress these kinds of complaints.
Daniel, we've got about 30 seconds left, and I wanted to ask you one quick question. John Conyers has been referred to the House Ethics Committee. Al Franken has been referred to the Senate Ethics Committee. What's the end game there? What could the committees do if they find that this abuse has indeed been committed?
I think they could deprive them of their seats or somehow penalize them, certainly put an end to their careers, effectively put an end to their careers. It could be very serious. But then again, what happens if Moore is elected in Alabama? What will the Senate do then? How will it respond? Will they deprive the guy of his seat or just sit back and watch while he, joins their numbers?
I think your question begs an answer, but I think your suggestion or perceived suggestion is correct. We've been joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He is a journalist and author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup in America's Undeclared War. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us every day at 105.5 FM. And, John, we're also now on an AM station.
We are indeed. We're on 1390 on the AM dial.
1390 on the AM dial. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.